Okay, good evening, everyone. Thank you, everyone, for joining in person. And for those of you on Zoom land, I assume that you're just all sick in bed, and that's why you can't come out in person. Otherwise, I know you would all be here in person. But it's good to see everyone in person and virtually. As I speak and give my general introduction, Maurice is going to be sending the source sheet into the chat in Zoom. So for those of you who are on Zoom, you can follow along as well. Okay, so before we really begin, I wanted to kind of just throw the question out to the crowd of, and maybe the doctors can hold off on answering, but what do we know about DNA in general? What's like common knowledge about DNA?
Genetic material.
Okay, good. Genetic material. What does that mean, genetic material?
And you can determine parental or related people using it.
Okay, there are a lot of assumptions with everything you just said, but so you're saying maybe you could determine that people are related with some sort of DNA testing. Okay, good. What else?
We call it the building blocks of life.
Okay, good. The building blocks of life. A lot of things are the building blocks of life. Okay, this is one of the building blocks of life. All right, what else? Any other common knowledge, maybe common misconceptions perhaps out there of what DNA is?
Well, the DNA is what determines what your hair color is going to be.
Okay, good, right? So it determines every element of what we look like, how we present to the other individuals out there in the world. And for those doctors, any things you could fill in? I'm looking at you.
I'm not a doctor.
You're a doctor. You're a doctor.
No, I'm not.
You're a doctor. All right. Any real doctors out there?
I am not a doctor.
Okay.
You are.
All right, fine. So no real doctors here, so I can really say whatever I want.
I'm a PhD in biology, though.
Oh, we already.
I'm a doctor, and I'm a geneticist.
You're a geneticist?
Yeah.
I didn't.
PhD in
bacterial genetics. Oh, my God. All right, yeah, so you're going to give the lecture tonight, Sam. We'll just... Okay, so what I wanted to do this evening, so now that no one here seems to know anything about DNA except for Sam, so that puts me in a good space, so I could say whatever I want. But what I wanted to do really was try to understand and define a little bit more of what the science of DNA actually is, of not trying to explain it, because quite frankly, I couldn't tell you on a scientific level what a lot of it actually means, but what the modern day conceptions of DNA is meant to accomplish, why it is such a critical element of the world that we live in nowadays, and how that then pertains to halacha as well. So we begin by taking a look at source number one. And it's really just a really important way to begin this year. It's a Gemara that can be found in Sanhedrin that tells us, the Mishnah teaches, and this serves to tell of the greatness of the Holy One, blessed be He, as when a person stamps several coins with one seal, they are all similar to each other. But the Supreme King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be He, stamped all people with the seal of Adam, the first man, as all are His offspring, and not one of them is similar to another. So what the Gemara in Sanhedrin sort of lays out for us at the outset is that there is this amazing fact of life, and whether it's 100% a fact or just like 99% of the time true, but more often than not, most people in the world and in human history do not look alike. Everyone has their own defining characteristics. You will have, like, I don't know how many of you have get, like, I'm a millennial, so I get sometimes stuck in like clicking on, you know, clickbait, and you like click on things that, not like inappropriate things, God forbid, but like you click on things that really waste time. And so there are like these lists that they have out there of, you know, people in 2022 who look like people who died 200 years ago, and it's really uncanny and weird. So that does exist out there, but for the most part, most people don't look alike, and even among those who look alike, there are some clearly defining characteristics for each individual. And so this goes all the way back to the times of the Gemara, where we are meant to understand that at the end of the day, whenever you have someone who is creating something, and we know this nowadays in the modern world, when production is made, when you produce something, so we have assembly lines, and we try to produce many of the same items, whereas opposed to a Kadosh Baruch Hu, God, when He creates mankind, every single person looks a little bit different than the next, some more than others, but at the end of the day, everyone looks a little bit different. So before we go any further, I'd like to kind of outline and help us understand that there are really two areas of DNA evidence that I want to refer to. One is the DNA evidence proper that we all think of when we hear DNA. That means like the DNA in our bodies. And then there's also fingerprinting and trying to understand that relevance in halacha, which we'll only discuss just for a few moments now at the beginning. But we're not going to... Maurice, did you see that message? Someone sent a message about if there are sources. Are you sending them?
No, I haven't seen the message. I'm busy trying to get the file.
Oh, okay. I can't see who messaged, but whoever just messaged, they're coming soon to a theater near you. So if you take a look at source number, so far we're only mostly going to be quoting Wikipedia things, so don't get too sad that you don't have the source sheets. So source number two is an excerpt from a Wikipedia page trying to understand fingerprinting. So a fingerprint is an impression left by the friction ridges of a human finger. The recovery of partial fingerprints from a crime scene is an important method of forensic science. Moisture and grease on a finger results in fingerprints on surfaces such as glass or metal, and I have this really cool diagram that now looks like everyone in the world has the source sheet, so hopefully everyone can open it and see it. And so there's this really cool diagram which kind of explains how a fingerprints analyst will go ahead and tell someone how these fingerprints can match another, and that is that they have certain minutiae, or what they're called, and they compare certain similarities between one fingerprint to the next, and ultimately they can determine if certain fingerprints match. What are the potential flaws with this system? Is fingerprinting a flawed system?
Anne thinks so, because she thinks every time she gets fingerprinted, she's going to be matched with the Jack the Ripper.
Listen, well, so and Anne would be 100% correct that there are many situations in the court of law nowadays where forensic scientists have been sort of called to defend themselves, whether or not fingerprinting is actually a legitimate science and whether or not it is actually a legitimate reason and a way to convict someone, because there are many faults in the system, as we'll see. We'll quote just one case in a few moments, but there are many systems examples of when fingerprinting has really been totally off, and as a result, we'll see that there's a strong difference between DNA matching and fingerprint matching, because DNA matching, it's clear that there is a lot more sort of just black and white fact to rely on, but when it comes to fingerprinting, it's much more subjective and not as simple. So let's take a look at source number three to understand DNA evidence a little bit more. Again, another great Wikipedia page. DNA profiling, also called DNA fingerprinting, is the process of determining an individual's DNA characteristics. DNA analysis intended to identify a species rather than an individual is called DNA barcoding. DNA profiling is a forensic technique in criminal investigations comparing criminal suspects' profiles to DNA evidence so as to assess the likelihood of their involvement in the crime. It is also used in paternity testing to establish immigration eligibility and in genealogical and medical research. DNA profiling has also been used in the study of animal and plant populations, etc., and goes on. Feel free to read on your own if you have any interest in learning more about how DNA evidence actually works. But let's ask the million-dollar question and sort of the elephant in the room, and that is, can DNA evidence be wrong? Can a scientist misunderstand that, say, someone is the, right? Anyone watch Maury Povich back in the day? Is that show still on the air? People know Maury Povich? Yeah, in Zoom, the Zoom world, do you guys know Maury Povich? No, you don't know Maury. Who doesn't know Maury Povich? All right, we'll have to have a conversation. Maury Povich, he had a talk show back in the day. I don't know if it's still on the air, but it was a great thing to watch when you stayed home from school. Maury Povich would have all these like really sleazy kind of people, and his only job in the world, evidently, was determining who was the father for a woman who had many, many sexual partners. And he would always do paternity testing. That was like his life's mission in the world. That's what he did. And so is there any fault in DNA testing? Can DNA lie?
I assume the DNA can be done at several different levels of complexity.
Okay.
And presumably the more complex you go and the more detail you collect, the less likely there is to be an error.
Okay, good. So Jim is saying correctly over here that if you have an advanced person who knows what they're doing, which hopefully if you're doing DNA sequencing and matching and the like, you have some understanding of what you're doing. Maury Povich retired. Who is that, Mofsky? Of course. He retired. Wow, that's a sad for the world that Maury Povich retired. Okay, who's going to do the paternity test now? Someone else, I guess. So Jim is saying correctly that really if you're doing this properly, then it's hard to make a mistake with DNA sequencing and matching because it is really more black and white. However, with that said, there are a few cases on record of individuals who were really the subject of a really big science experiment that they did not realize they were a part of, and that no one really realized they were a part of until they realized they were all a part of it. And if you take a look at source number 4, there is a great article that's entitled "She's Her Own Twin." This was a very big news case. It was a woman who her DNA material, her genetic material, was taken, and it was compared with her 3 children, and it turned out that she was not the mother of the 3 children that she had carried. So that's a little interesting. How could that take place, that she is not the mother of the 3 children she carried? So it's a really long article. It's actually a fascinating read, so feel free again on your own time to read through it. We're not going to go through it now because I don't want to spend all the time. But basically, the article explains that this woman was having a bit of a crisis because she was being put on trial, essentially, for almost potentially being a woman who had maybe kidnapped these children, or maybe she was a surrogate mother and they were never really supposed to be her children. And ultimately, what the scientists involved ended up figuring out was that she was an individual who I believe the term is a chimera. Someone who knows something about science, they'll tell me if I'm right or wrong. But basically, she is an individual who, when she was in utero, she ate her own twin, or that's like the fancy way of saying that her twin that she had was absorbed into her. And as a result, what ended up happening was that most of her body had one sort of DNA material, but there were other parts of her body that had a different type of DNA material. So her blood would match one sort of DNA sequencing, and the flesh of her body would match what would be another type of DNA sequencing. So when her DNA was taken and it was compared to her children, and it turned out that it didn't match, it's because the children did not have the DNA sequencing from one part of her body, but rather from another part of her body. So ultimately, this was one of the most popular cases in proving that DNA evidence and DNA comparisons may not be 100% correct. But again, the only reason over here why it was proven to be a faulty science was because of the exception and not because of the rule. She was a unique case, and there are many cases out there where this does apply, where an individual may absorb the twin in utero. But again, this is not this is much more the exception and not as much the rule. So more often than not, in a simple case, DNA evidence is more or less 100% correct. Again, not in all cases because of this, but in most cases, it is 100% correct. And so therefore, there's obviously a strong difference in terms of how halachically we would view something like fingerprinting versus DNA evidence. Fingerprinting, when there are so many different faults and many possibilities to make a mistake, so you'll say that it should really have very little relevance whatsoever. However, when it comes to DNA comparisons, then there should be a lot of room to use it as at least a tool to help us and assist us when we might need it. Before going any further, we'll just also go to source number 5 very quickly.
Can I ask a question? I'm sorry.
Yeah, sure.
I thought also there had been cases, though, where obviously we want everyone to be an expert who's handling the DNA, but there were mistakes, not because they looked at one and thought it belonged to someone else, but because DNA is, especially fingerprints and things like that, are so fragile. I don't know how to describe it. People's DNA can end up all over, they can end up in a crime scene sometimes where they weren't the ones who did crime, or even that in the lab sometimes things got mixed up. Like, they brush one against another.
Right. So you are 100% correct that most of us, when we think of like DNA evidence, we think of like NCIS or Law and Order, where everything works out so perfectly and then there's an amazing conclusion to the whole thing. So that's not really how the world works. DNA evidence could be incredibly complex because of the many different people who might have been in the room at the time of an incident or something of the like. So it's not a perfect science. But that said, when you are dealing with an expert who is taking, let's say, the DNA evidence of hair out of a brush and testing it, that in and of itself is a pretty flawless science. It's only when it's sort of tested in the real world that it becomes a lot more complicated. That's my understanding. Again, I gave a class recently, and someone told me only afterwards. They corrected me with something I was wrong about, and they said they didn't want to embarrass me. So certainly when it comes to non-Torah matters, this happened to be a Torah matter, but certainly when it comes to non-Torah matters, please feel free to correct me, because I know most things, but not everything. I am only an expert on 95% of things in the world. So with that said, let's take a look at source number 5 very quickly. And so this is a case of that proves how faulty fingerprinting could be. And this is from the very famous Madrid bombings in 2004. So following the 2004 Madrid train bombings, fingerprints on a bag containing detonating devices were found by Spanish authorities. The Spanish National Police shared the fingerprints with the FBI through Interpol. 20 possible matches for one of the fingerprints were found in the FBI database, and one of the possible matches was Brandon Mayfield. His prints were in the FBI database as they were taken as part of a standard procedure when he joined the military. Anyways, long story short, he was a suspect for the bombing in Madrid. He wasn't even in Madrid when the bombing took place, but he was a prime suspect until a few weeks later, the authorities in Madrid actually found the real suspect and the clear perpetrator of the whole action. And what is specifically amazing about this case of Brandon Mayfield is that there were three separate fingerprint experts who said that, of course, the fingerprints that they found near the bombing had to have been Brandon Mayfield's, and every single one of them, who again they were all asked separately, they all got this totally wrong. And this poor man who was living, I think it was in Seattle, Washington, almost went to had a very bad rest of his life, and I think he ended up actually suing the FBI for millions of dollars because this was a horrible example where justice did not play the role that it should have played. And so this shows us, though, that fingerprints are much faultier in terms of being able to determine their true source. And so as a result, fingerprints will not really be the source of the rest of the conversation because of how faulty they are as a science. Okay, so now that we understand basically the science, there's DNA, there is fingerprints. We like DNA a lot more. It's hard to mess up DNA, although there are circumstances where it can be messed up. When would DNA evidence be relevant for halacha? Why would we in Judaism ever need to use DNA evidence? For Mori Povich.
You could determine coding status through Y.
Oh, okay, good. So we'll get there at the end. There is potentially what became known as the Kohen gene, and we'll just dovetail on that. There is also what became known as the Jewish gene, and so perhaps you can say that you can prove someone is Jewish or you can prove someone is a Kohen with these genes. I have personal experience. I, for a very short amount of time, was a Kohen. We'll talk about that at the end. I'm not joking, but it's a funny story nonetheless. Okay, good. So that's one potential area, and as Jim said, yes, maybe to determine if someone is the father, to say that he is obligated to pay child support and things like that. Or maybe what would be another significant case in which DNA determination of making sure that this child belonged to someone, why would that be significant?
Like a kidnapping, or if there's that related to the same thing, but if there's an unidentified dead person.
Okay. Oh, okay, good. Right. So if there's an unidentified dead person that we want to identify, so I believe you're referring to the case of a gunot, and you have a woman. So
really, that's exactly what I was getting at.
So in halacha, in general, in Orthodox law, we believe that the only way that we'll talk one-sided for a second. The only way a woman can get out of a marriage is two ways. Either the husband gives her a get, or, which is the divorce document, or he dies. So that's so different women will have different perspectives on what they want, how they want this to go. But what happens if the man just... Sorry?
Why not?
You could be both. But what happens if the man just disappears? And what perhaps might be a modern-day example where a man might just disappear?
9/11.
Good. 9/11, there were 15 Jews in the World Trade Center, all who perished. And so this became a source of tremendous debate that you could find maybe an arm fragment or a couple of hair fragments that were found here and there, but the very few bodies were actually taken out of the rubble. And so can you say that I'm going to test this hand for DNA evidence, determine absolutely that it's Yankel Shmankel, and Yankel Shmankel's wife is now able to remarry? Is that something that that we can do? One final potential case that you might bring some relevance from a Jewish perspective is that in Judaism, we believe, although some of us, we may not even realize this is a relevant halacha nowadays, but there's something called yibum, and that is that if a woman is married to a man, and that man has a brother, and the man who's married, he dies without any children, so there is an obligation on a halachic level for the brother to marry the wife. However, we nowadays do something called chalitza, which is a whole process with like a spitting in the shoe. If you know about it, great. If you don't know about it and you're curious, ask me afterwards. If the man had potentially a child, so you can maybe prove, and then maybe there's some gray matter in the situation that you're not sure if that child is the man's child, so maybe DNA evidence and matching could determine if that is the child. Okay, so with all these different types of cases, we see that DNA evidence could be significant in a way that we have never been able to necessarily prove and deal with certain cases, but DNA evidence makes life a lot easier for us. So, take a look quickly at source number 6. It's an excerpt from an article in dealing with the Aguna problems that happened as a result of 9/11. So take a look inside. When unthinkable disaster struck a decade ago, and this was written in, I think, 2011, and close to 3,000 people were murdered at the World Trade Center, the scale of destruction created a unique challenge for victims' families' identification of the dead. With only fragmented human remains and degraded DNA left in the wake of 9/11, that task became, in the words of the National Institute of Justice, the greatest forensic challenge ever undertaken in this country. For the families of Jewish victims, this probably was particularly thorny. According to Jewish law, a woman cannot remarry unless she has definitive proof of her husband's death, lest she inadvertently enter into an adulterous relationship. Jewish law dictates that death can be proven in three ways: physical evidence, eyewitness testimony of the death, and certain confirmation that the person had been in a situation in which survival was essentially impossible, right? What's another not as modern day example, but that this did happen in many situations? Anyone have any other circumstances when this might have taken place? Oh, good. The Holocaust. So the Holocaust, there are some very sad cases of which more often than not you would assume that someone had passed away and someone was murdered, rather. But there were numerous cases where, what do you know? The long-lost husband actually came back after 40 years of not being together. They found each other once again. The problem that became for a lot of Orthodox rabbis of in those times was trying to determine, well, so this woman, she remarried and she had children, but she also had a previous marriage that was never really ended, even though she thought it was. So what is the status of these children? Are they, right? Sorry? Right. So are the kids, are they considered what we call a mamzer, right? Which the English translation is illegitimate, but that's not actually what it really means. But essentially, for a mamzer, this child is not able to marry into the regular Jewish population. And so that was a serious, serious concern. And that's really what makes the Aguna case in general so significant. If these individuals in 9/11, if the women remarried, and it turns out that they were actually wrong, that 30 years later, actually one of the husbands just fled from the buildings. And I think there were some cases of individuals who just fled and had some insurance claims, like life insurance claims, right? I think there were one or two that came out of 9/11.
I think that this is, we're looking at where things that are 99.999% accurate, and then we're finding things on the internet where, you know, the rare cases where fingerprints are not definitive and DNA is not definitive. But I actually believe that it is not true that anybody ran away from the World Trade Center.
Okay. I really wasn't sure. I thought that I did hear that, but.
This, I think example six, for those of us in the Rochester community, really strikes a nerve, because in our community there was a young father who disappeared about 20 years ago.
Okay.
And we all know this family. And his car was found.
His phone was found.
All of his possessions were found.
Okay.
Parked alongside the Niagara River upstream of Niagara Falls.
Okay.
And he was not found.
So what ended up happening?
He was found?
Well, I'm getting to that part.
Oh.
So, my punchline.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So this.
He was eventually found.
Yes, I was.
All right, give Kale a minute to get. She's making it dramatic for those of us who don't know the story.
Yeah, anyways, so this, unfortunately, the wife spent a great deal of time. She had the husband's DNA from his razors and toothbrushes and hairbrushes, and there were unidentified findings of body parts that could possibly be his. And it was multiple years before it was actually proven, unfortunately, that this was him.
Wow.
She no longer lives in the community, but it's a very sad story.
Yeah.
But it really strikes a nerve. But,
yeah.
You know, I think that for those of us reading this, I think everybody here, probably immediately thought of this.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. I had no idea.
And the children and the stress of the length of time between the disappearance and the ultimate identification.
Yeah, 100%. No, thank you for sharing that. And yeah, I am not trying to make any statements about what the reality of the science is, but rather the goal is now going to try to understand, does halacha view DNA as you explained, as 99.99% accurate? So is that relevant or perhaps not? So with that in mind, so let's take a look at source number 7. Source number 7 is a Mishnah in Maseches Yevamos that helps us understand the old-fashioned case of an aguna was one where a man was lost at sea, or a man was not found, and then he was found many years later. So how do we determine if the man is actually who we think it might be or not? So says the Mishnah, one may testify that a man died only if he can testify about seeing the countenance of the face with the nose, as this allows one to identify the individual with certainty. Although there are distinguishing marks on his body and his personal belongings, which appear to indicate his identity, one may not rely on these as identification, right? This is what we call circumstantial evidence. There is not that much just because you see the car, just because you see the phone. It's not an absolute in a proof that this did happen. Furthermore, one may not testify that a person died until his soul actually departs. And even if one saw him cut open and severely wounded or crucified or with a wild animal eating parts of him, he may not testify that he died. And so essentially what this Mishnah helps us understand is that even though it seems like there is a pretty darn good chance someone is gone, unless you can say nearly unequivocally, almost perhaps even 100% sure, whatever that means in our world, unless you can say almost 100% that a person is no longer here, you have to assume that the person is still alive on a halachic level. And this, therefore, is further explained in source number 8. The Gemara says, well, okay, that's very nice. You want to assume that you have all the circumstantial evidence, so you don't want to assume that the person is neither here nor there. However, what if you have something that is like really indicative that the person is not alive? Perhaps we'll put in DNA evidence. Maybe DNA evidence is such a clear indicator. So the person is not recognizable. You only found a few body parts or whatever it is. So is the DNA evidence, will it allow you to determine that this was in fact the real person, even though you didn't have anyone see him actually die? Can you say that this did happen unequivocally? So says the Gemara in source number 8, and there are those who say that Rava said that everyone agrees that distinguishing marks are relied upon by rabbinic law, However, this is referring to ordinary distinguishing marks. Marks that are exceptionally unusual may be relied upon even according to Torah law. So in other words, everyone agrees that there are different types of simanim. There are different types of signs out there. You have a person who has a unique looking nose, so that perhaps is pretty identifying. But again, something like maybe DNA or something like, what's another good example of a clear marker on someone? Okay, good. Maybe a tattoo, maybe a scar, a mole, maybe something like that. Everyone knew that this guy had the mole in the shape of a butterfly on his left shoulder. So these types of things, maybe they would be indicative of some clearer determination that this person was actually there, even though the face might not actually be determinative. So what about, what are some other simanim, some other signs that you might say could identify someone, but they're not necessarily so strong? What would be a good sign, but not the strongest of signs?
Well, they use dental records all the
time. Okay, good, good. Maybe dental records. What else? What if the body, God forbid, but the body of Shaquille O'Neal, right? So he is a very large person, a very tall person. Let's say, God forbid, something happened to him, and you found someone, however tall he is, 7 foot, whatever, someone like him matching that description, but the face wasn't recognizable. So with someone's height, again, when they're unusually tall, could that perhaps be a good sign? What do you think?
Yeah.
Some people say yes. Anyone say no?
Maybe close. Not that unusual.
Not that unusual. Okay.
You know, so say...
With other circumstances.
Probably there's several hundred thousand people in the world who are that tall.
Right.
You know, so that doesn't identify that alone. That
right.
With some other things, maybe.
Right,
but,
okay.
You know, any one unusual mole or height or any one thing... is probably insufficient based on the fact that there's 8 billion people in the
okay,
world.
Okay, good,
you know,
good.
Somebody else is going to have a mole.
Okay.
Or be tall.
Okay,
know?
Good.
Somebody with a prosthesis.
Okay, good. So maybe someone with a prosthesis, that could be. And so, right, so now we're talking about two different things. You could have someone who is missing a limb, which that is not the most unique thing on the face of the earth, but perhaps someone who actually has the prosthesis and you can actually match a serial number, right? So, or however, you know, that could actually be very significant. The bar of trying to determine of what type of a sign or what type of a symbol is significant and is not significant, this is the source of tremendous debate. And as you can imagine, this therefore is the major question when it comes to DNA. So for example, so maybe there are two people in the world, it could be, that have a butterfly shaped mole on their upper right shoulder. And so let's say we assume that that therefore cannot be considered a unique identifying factor. Well, okay, so that's less than 0.001% of the population. Yeah.
So I remembered there was remains of an ancient figure, and they can measure the nose, how the nose, they can tell, they can reconstruct sort of what they think the person would have looked like by measuring even the bones.
Yeah.
You can reconstruct and the hair that the person's had. That, I mean, that's one of the things that stays even when somebody has like decades. So there are a lot of scientific measures of the skull. The art you can tell by the nose, how even if it's, it's deteriorated.
That's how the apple... facial recognition works. It's all ratios of the dimensions of the eyes, the nose, the brow line. It's not necessarily things that we would ordinarily as humans identify each other by.
Right, so it would actually be interesting to see what the margin of error is in facial, relatively sophisticated facial recognition. I wonder, how correct it is and how, if people look similar, would it not be able to determine the difference? It's an interesting question.
Well, apparently, it's good enough for a company to make billions of dollars selling phones that recognize the owner by face.
I'm not sure for that
commercial purpose, possibly not to identify, who the murderer is,
right.
But it's good enough.
Yeah, I mean,
for that purpose.
Yeah, I imagine the error is not that large, but it's...
Yeah, it's not good enough for, like criminal proceedings,
right.
But for the everyday use of phones, apparently they're able to sell them. That it's good enough.
Well,
a lot of
people could sell things.
People in the room are willing to say, well, I'll be the only one who can make my phone work, and you won't be able to.
Right.
And then even if we passed everybody's phones around, I don't have this feature, but if I did, it's pretty unlikely that it's so weak that you could be in a room full of people,
right.
And somebody else could make your phone work.
Yeah, it'd just be interesting. I don't know if it's like if it's a 1% error or a 0.0001%. It just if anyone happens to know the facts, feel free.
I'm sure Apple would be happy to tell you.
I'm sure they would.
Yeah.
Or not tell us. This is depending on. Okay, so with this, you can imagine, therefore, that when it comes to DNA, there are a multiplicity of perspectives out there, and they all really range from DNA is very reliable, that it's what we would call a simen muvhak, that which means that it's a really strong indicator, and some who will say no, that DNA is not really a simen at all, that maybe all it should do for us is that it should just establish that it's just one of the many circumstantial factors that you can use to decide. And again, this is just a halachic argument, how we view something that is totally foreign to Chazal, that our rabbis were not familiar with. So if they were alive nowadays, where they would weigh this in terms of the various different levels of simanim, of signs that we have. So in source number 10, we have Rav Asher Weiss. So Rav Asher Weiss, for those of you who are not familiar, he is a very great gadol in our community. He's one of the four major rabbis that the Orthodox Union actually used to help determine some of the approaches to the whole COVID pandemic and how we approached it in general. So he writes, and I apologize, I didn't have time to translate it, but we'll read it and translate it together. Venire Barur de Bedikas. Anyone want to take a crack at what that acronym is? Good, DNA. DNA. Dina kisiman muvhak. Vikvar kavu harishonim da'afti bayalan im simanam do'oraisa o'derabanan siman muvhak kule alma havi do'oraisa. So he explains that everyone would agree that if you have a siman muvhak, which is, again, just a really strong sign, that everyone agrees that that would be a strong determining factor. And he says very clearly that this is what DNA is. You can't say, even though there may be some small margin of error, it's really small. And so to throw the whole baby out with the bathwater just because there's one or two weird cases that you can find and put in a shear, that's ridiculous. And so therefore he says DNA is very reliable and can be used in significant circumstances. When it comes to other opinions that exist out there. So again, there are those who tell you that it's just an extra indicator. There are those who will tell you that really it's nearly insignificant, that when it comes down to it, that this is not something that we sort of would use to actually make any sort of a clear determination. Is it interesting? Does it give you maybe some more strength to feel good about your argument? Perhaps. But at the end of the day, there are those who would sort of just say that DNA is not necessarily a halachically relevant consideration. And if you take a look at source number 11, again, we're not going to read through the whole source over here, but this is just an excerpt from a much larger essay written by Rabbi Chaim Jachter in his, he has several books called Gray Matter. And in these books, Gray Matter, he talks about the modern different halachic questions that we have nowadays. And one of them was the 9/11 tragedy and the 15 agunot. And in particular, he mentions and talks about that there were 10 cases that came to the Beth Din of America. The Beth Din of America, for those of us who may not be familiar, is the primary, I hate to use the words modern Orthodox, but like Yeshiva University and the Beth Din of America are sort of synonymous. And that the Beth Din of America is like the major Beth Din for our larger community. And so they were brought 10 cases of agunot, of these women who lost their husbands, to determine if they would be able to remarry, just with whatever evidence they might have had. Some was DNA. Some was very circumstantial, like they had a video of one gentleman, I think, walking into the building it was, you know, the timestamp was a minute or so before the plane hit. So it was very, very difficult cases. But the Beth Din of America ruled very leniently and said that all of these cases, the women were able to remarry, because there's a general rule in halacha that when it comes to cases of a gunot, of a woman who may not be able to remarry, we are incredibly lenient as a general rule. This is something that dates back for thousands of years, that we never want a woman to have to suffer. And therefore, as a result, just because of a technicality that she should be not unable to remarry is something that was unacceptable. So as a result, all 10 cases that came to the Beth Din of America were all ruled that all these women were able to remarry, albeit that there was actually, I think, one case where there was nearly, there was basically no evidence that the person was in the building for whatever reason. It was just like all the stars aligned that there was very little, but even that individual was proven as well to be found to be considered halachically dead so that the woman could remarry. So when it comes to agunot, when it comes to DNA evidence, how did the Beth Din of America use this sort of information? And so the answer is that they kind of used it whenever they needed to use it, but they didn't use it when they didn't need to use it. In other words, when it was clear that there were many other factors that they were able to determine to say, oh, it's very obvious that this person was in the tower on the 100-something floor, you know, 2 minutes before the plane hit. So of course, we can understand very clearly that this individual is no longer, you know, on this planet. However, when it was not as clear exactly how we can match them, but there were bone fragments or DNA fragments, then the Beth Din of America did use DNA whenever it was necessary and whenever it was actually helpful. And so therefore, even though there is a very broad spectrum of opinions in terms of how we view DNA in halacha, certainly in this instance, it was very, very necessary and very helpful to determine that the man was no longer alive in a few different cases. Yeah, does someone have a question? Okay. So with that said, let's now spend just a few final moments trying to understand the other cases that this might be relevant for. And in particular, I want to bring up a fascinating case, which comes up in source number 12 that we'll do outside. But it was a question that was asked to Rav Sternbach. Rav Sternbach, one of the great gedolim of the 20th century. And he had the following question come to him. A doctor who hopefully knew some science, he determined, based on various tests that he was doing for the family, that based on the blood type that the children had, that it was clear that the father, who was the father, was actually not the father. And the doctor wanted to know, on a halachic level, is he required to tell the family, destroy the family, when clearly something's not right over here? Would he be required to tell the kids or the mother or the father that, by the way, there is no way scientifically that these kids are your kids based on the blood type evidence that he had? So what would you say? Should the doctor be required? Because again, in the possibility that these children were actually from a different union, from perhaps even an affair, then it could be that they would then be mamzerim, and they couldn't really even marry into the regular community. So that's a significant thought to have. So what do you say? Should the doctor be required? Yeah?
Further question.
Okay.
What if it was artificial insemination from a sperm bank?
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, good. So the post can talk about that question as well. And not just in a circumstance like this, but let's say you have someone there are sperm banks that are very strict that they do not give the identity of the sperm donors out. So let's say someone has a child from a sperm donor through artificial insemination. So there is a halachic principle that if you don't know where you come from, then it's unclear who you can marry, because anyone in the world could be your sibling. And of course, halachically, it's not permissible to marry your sibling. So what do you do in that circumstance? So that comes up as well. But let's go back to this case of the doctor. So should the doctor be required to tell the family, yes or no?
As I understand, blood typing is not as accurate as DNA by a long shot.
Okay.
And so there would be a margin of error, and I think that he would not be required, because the chances of making a mistake and destroying a family is not worth bringing it up.
Okay, so Rabbi Anderson tells us that because of the margin of error over here, then it wouldn't be worthwhile to say anything. Anyone else disagree with that and say, no, we should tell the family?
Well, you know,
I think it would be a violation of, not related to Jewish law, but I think it would be a violation of his medical ethics to tell anyone other than the person whose blood he drew.
But let's say they all sign papers that say that you're allowed to tell the spouse or whatever, right? That exists in the world.
There's a lot of other factors. What if that person had leukemia and got a bone marrow transplant. Now he's got a different blood type.
Okay, good, good, could be. All right, so there are all these potential reasons why this doctor might be incorrect. Sir Sternbach essentially ended up saying that no matter what, this doctor, even if he was very clearly correct, and even if his assumptions were spot on, nonetheless, he would not be required and should not seemingly say anything to the family for the very simple reason that when it comes to issues like this, we don't only use science. In fact, science should be the last place we turn more often than not, but rather we go based on things like chazakas. A chazaka is the sky has been blue today. That's right, rather, the sky was blue yesterday. The sky was blue the day before. I haven't been outside yet today, but I'm pretty sure the sky is blue today as well. And so therefore, halacha works a lot like that. If the status was X for so long, even if that was perhaps based on some faulty assumptions, but that's how long, but it's been going on for a long time that we assume X is the case, so we don't have a right to break in and assume that now it's not X, but rather Y, unless we have a significant factor and scientific evidence, or at least blood typing in this case, would not be significant. And therefore, what the poskim tell us is that when it comes to a more direct case of a mamzer, so for example, let's say you have no real way of knowing that someone might be a mamzer, right? That is in a very black and white case. Let's say there was potentially an affair and she doesn't know who the father is. So would you be obligated to say that this kid should get a DNA test to go on Mori Povich and determine who is the father? And then you can see if it's the person who it shouldn't be in this specific case, then maybe the kid might be a mamzer. So would you be required to do that? And the poskim most of them seemingly say that no, because when it comes down to it, even though DNA evidence is very strong and you can use it in many cases, from a halakhic standpoint, you would not, or you should not rather, rely on DNA evidence when all it could do is hurt you. Again, when DNA evidence could be helpful, like in the case of an aguna, then we say absolutely we should include it. But when it comes to a case of someone like a mamzer, then more often than not, the poskim are very against it, because why are you trying to destroy the family? Again, there are circumstances where some members of the family might demand it, and that's a separate case. But in terms of black and white, what is the Torah perspective? So more often than not, we say just live and let live. And if we have every right to assume that for whatever reason this kid is the right father's child, then we should just assume that and move from there. And with that, we'll make two final concluding points to try to understand where DNA could be relevant in terms of establishing Jewish status, and also in terms of establishing Kohen status. So if you take a look in source number 13, so there is a wonderful book called DNA in Halacha, written by Rabbi Bleich, one of the Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshiva University, and a lot of the sources that we brought up this evening come from this book. And he explains that, while there are certain genetic markers perhaps that point to that this person might be an Ashkenaz Jew, for example, that's not necessarily a proof of anything. It just happens to be indicative of some other factor. So take a look in source number 13. No one has claimed that all or even a majority of Ashkenazic Jews share a single genetic marker. The evidence does show that some 40% of Ashkenazic Jews are endowed with mitochondrial DNA that can be traced back to four women. Those genetic components are extremely rare in non-Jewish populations, but interestingly enough, they do occur in low frequencies in non-Ashkenazic Jews. Similarly, most individual non-Ashkenazic Jewish communities similarly have a high representation of their own unique genetic markers attributable to a small group of female founders ranging in number from 1 to 6. Present-day Ashkenazic Jews are believed to be descended from a pool of less than 25,000 individuals who began to immigrate from northern Italy to the Rhine basin in the early part of the 14th century. So what we find when it comes to these potential genetic markers of the Jewish gene, and is this a real thing? So the answer is that at the end of the day, even if there is some proof that perhaps it could actually help you determine and say that someone might have some Jewish connection because of a gene that you find in the mitochondrial DNA, nonetheless, from a halachic standpoint, this is not something that we would consider valuable or relevant. So when might this be important for us nowadays to take into consideration?
Whether the law of return in Israel applies to you.
Okay, good, right? So the law of return in Israel, if you are Jewish, then you get to return. And so the big question is, when you, let's say you have a DNA test and you determine you have a certain marker, so there's obviously a difference between the halacha and how the Israeli government would come down. I don't think the Israeli government would find it meaningful either. However, when it comes to the halacha, it's also very relevant for determining, let's say you have, and this is a very modern issue in Israel, there's this conversion crisis that many Russian immigrants in particular came over after the fall of the Iron Curtain, and now you have all these millions of Russians who they say they're Jewish, but they don't necessarily have the ability to prove it. So would a DNA test help over here? And more often than not, it's seemingly insignificant because of the many different faults in, not in the DNA system, but in the Jewish marker potentiality. So therefore, most, if not all rabbis, I believe, say that there is no necessary value in this. And this is also true when it comes to the Kohen gene. And so I know the hour is late, so hopefully the story will wake everyone up and buy me 5 more minutes. So when I was in high school, an individual in my family who will go unnamed, who is an interesting person in my family, he told me that he took the Kohen test, and he found out that he was a Kohen. And this individual, being a Kohen, would for various reasons mean that I too was a Kohen. So I was not super religious at this point, but who doesn't want to be a Kohen? Like, how fun is that, right? If you just find out one day that you're a Kohen, so that's right, I could do it. Look at this, I'm clearly. So if you could do the hand sign, it must be. So for a few years, I went as a Kohen. I took the Kohen Aliyah, right? No one ever said Ein Kan Kohen. When I was around, I got to go up there and get the Aliyah. Do we actually rely on this on a halachic level? So several years being into it, I asked the question to a few different rabbeim of mine, most notably there were two rabbeim that basically gave me the answer unequivocally, and one was Avigdor Nevinzal, one of the great rabbeim who lives in the Old City in Jerusalem, and the other was Rabbi Mordechai Willig, my rebbe in YU, and they both basically said that there is no significance in a blood test to determine the Kohen gene for many reasons, but perhaps most importantly because the test itself is kind of flawed. There are so many different studies that have now come out. This all started in the late 1990s, I believe. There were researchers in Haifa who had determined that if all Kohanim all come from Aaron, so that's a much smaller DNA pool than, let's say, all Jews. And so there was hope that perhaps there would be some sort of a specific markers in the Y chromosome. Long story short, there's for some people there isn't, and rather what's more significant is that we go based on, again, chazaka. If we assume that this person, his father was a Kohen and his grandfather was a Kohen, then this person could therefore go as a Kohen. There is a belief, by the way, that nowadays there are very few Kohanim who actually would be believed to serve as a Kohen in the temple. And so what that means is there's 5 families in Israel who can trace their lineage all the way back to Aaron HaKohen, and so they're assumed to... Sorry? No, there are 5 families who say they can, and it's believed they can on a halachic level. Okay, is that a good way to say it? On a halachic genealogical level, they are able to determine that, and therefore they can say seemingly without a shadow of a doubt on a halachic level that they are Kohanim, but everyone else is the chazaka rule, and that is to say that you assume that your father, your grandfather was a Kohen, then you can be a Kohen as well. And this also therefore leads us to one final question of what about an individual who does some genealogical research and goes ahead and finds their great-great-grandfather buried in Europe, and they see on the tombstone the Kohen sign, right? Many Kohanim have on their tombstone like the symbol of Duchening. So would that be significant? And it's actually very complicated, and it doesn't happen too frequently, but it does happen every now and again. And if that does happen to you, you let me know. We'll talk about it. But there are multiple different answers that are given. More often than not, though, I believe the perspective that is shared is that it's halachically insignificant because, again, this person was already going for multiple generations at this point point as a Yisrael, so to now just assume he was a Kohen because, you know, six generations before someone had some duchening on the tombstone is halachically not a significant fact. And with that, we ultimately therefore see that DNA evidence really is kind of, I hate to say it like this, but it's halachically significant when we need it to be, but it's halachically insignificant when we don't need it to be, which is really kind of a very powerful and empowering fact, that the rabbis are strong enough and utilize modern science when it's necessary and when it's really helpful, but when it could be damaging, they kind of say, no, we have other areas that we rely on and we don't like DNA as much. And so therefore, with that, we conclude. If anyone has any questions, feel free to come over and ask afterwards, but wish everyone a beautiful evening.